You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, there are 9 U.S. Supreme Court justices, but our guest says America would be a lot better off with 59. He'll explain the problems he sees with the current court and why he says 59 might be the magic number. Now the United States is in talks with Mexico on a deal that could have asylum seekers staying in Mexico as they wait for their claims to be processed. It's known as a safe third country agreement, and if it goes into effect, it could reduce the number of migrants coming into the U.S. Nick Miroff is a national security reporter who covers immigration enforcement and homeland security for The Washington Post. Nick, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Good to be with you.
Well, I know there's not a deal in place, but in the abstract, what are they talking about here? What is the U.S. looking for in an agreement like this?
Well, so this is something that has picked up steam in recent weeks and months. It's been on the U.S. wish list for a while, but it's never been discussed at quite as high levels as it has recently. And basically what this would do would be to force asylum seekers from third countries, particularly Central America, who are now the majority of the asylum seekers who arrive at the border, it would force them to make that claim in Mexico, and it would allow the United States to immediately deport any third country nationals, Central Americans in this case, who cross illegally. So the U.S. could just quickly turn them around. And you know, this is something that officials at the Homeland Security Department believe would result in a quick, and substantial drop in the number of people who arrive to claim asylum.
And you mentioned we're seeing higher level talks on this that we'd seen in the past. So what's going on with negotiations right now?
Well, the tricky thing is we're between Mexican administrations, and what's happened is I think the U.S. feels like it had been making significant headway with the administration of Enrique Peña Nieto, and members of his government have been coming around to the idea because they increasingly came to view it as in their interest as well, knowing that that it could potentially, you know, make a dent in the, you know, the revenues of smuggling networks and organized crime, and also knowing that the U.S. would be prepared to offer significant financial assistance to them, I think, to do this. The tricky thing is, you know, Mexico just had an election in which leftist candidate Andrés Manuel López Obrador won a landslide victory, and he is coming in with a different mandate and a plan to really mark a significant break with the previous government. And the kind of relationship that he would have with the Trump administration remains to be seen. The question is the outgoing government of Mexico willing to potentially do this during the lame duck phase of the Peña Nieto administration?
And it seems like there might be some hope on the American part that, hey, with this lame duck administration, they've got nothing to lose. They're on their way out anyway. Maybe this is a window to get something on the books.
Exactly. And they also, I think, you know, Mexico and the U.S. are engaged in very crucial NAFTA talks right now. And so the Mexicans potentially can gain some leverage here on this point, you know, thinking that if they do something that the Americans have been, you know, really want on immigration, will it, give them a leg up in the NAFTA talks? And, you know, that also remains to be seen.
Talking to national security reporter Nick Miroff from The Washington Post about negotiations between the U.S. and Mexico that would require migrants coming up from Central America, mainly. If they want to apply to asylum for asylum in the U.S., they'd have to do it from Mexico. And, Nick, let's talk about those asylum seekers. What happens to them while they're there in Mexico applying for asylum? Where do they stay? Who's responsible for them? What do we know about that?
Well, I want to clarify one thing. This would be that, you know, they would have to get asylum in Mexico.
In Mexico, sorry.
Yeah, it wouldn't be to apply to come to the United States. It would essentially be the argument being, well, look, if they were in danger in Central America, that's why they're fled. Well, now they're in another country that is safe for them. And we've had an agreement like this with Canada since 2004, and you could see the logic of that in that Canada is a nation with a similar system of laws and protections. The argument is that Mexico is not, and Mexico has a significant rule of law issues and a large presence of organized crime. And so the question is, is Mexico a safe country for Central American asylum seekers? Is it a place where they would find safe refuge? And so, I think that's a big question. And critics of this controversial proposal point out that, Mexico isn't a safe country, and our own State Department has travel warnings that tell American citizens to avoid, entire sections of Mexico because they're so dangerous.
And theoretically, somebody coming across the Mexican border from Central America would be applying for asylum, I guess, in a border state. Are these particularly unsafe places right now?
Yeah, these are some of the most dangerous parts of Mexico. I mean, the border states are the, in some cases, the places where the biggest organized crime presence, and a place where migrants from Central America are routinely preyed upon by criminals and kidnappers. So, I think the anticipation here, or at least the expectation among U.S. officials, is that if Central Americans didn't think that they would be able to reach the United States, they would probably choose to stay put. It's not so much that Mexico would just take on an equal number of asylum seekers that are trying to come to the United States. It's that they would just stop attempting to make the journey entirely because the attraction of going to Mexico isn't so great, and because they don't, in this administration and at the Department of Homeland Security think that the majority of asylum seekers are economic migrants. They're not really fleeing, a lethal threat.
And the Trump administration and the Justice Department have said for asylum status, they will not necessarily consider threats like domestic violence or gang violence as qualifying for asylum status. Does that fit into this potential agreement with Mexico? Would they be operating under the same assumptions?
No, Mexico would have to have, they would be subject to Mexican law. I mean, what you're citing here is part of, a broader crackdown on the asylum process, a tightening of the asylum process to make it harder and harder for Central American migrants to not only to win asylum claims in the United States, but even to pass that initial step, the so-called credible fear interview, in which an asylum officer at the border determines whether or not you have a credible story and there could potentially be a risk to your life. So the U.S. has been trying to tighten that up, and if these migrants, were compelled to stay in Mexico, well, they would have to follow the Mexican laws and Mexican asylum procedures. And I think, part of the plan here would be that the U.S. would work with Mexico, and other countries would work with Mexico to try to develop a more robust asylum, system in Mexico.
We'll leave it there for now. Nick, thanks a lot for bringing us up to date on this.
My pleasure. Anytime.
That's Nick Miroff, national security reporter for The Washington Post, talking about negotiations between the U.S. and Mexico on a deal that would make asylum seekers apply for asylum in Mexico instead of the United States. First President Trump's Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh has been meeting with individual senators ahead of his confirmation process. No hearing date has been scheduled, but Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell says he expects Kavanaugh to get the thumbs up by October 1st. Kavanaugh is Trump's second Supreme Court pick. He would succeed Justice Anthony Kennedy, who announced he's retiring at the end of this month. The move has liberals worried about future rulings and conservatives excited about boosting their influence on the court. According to our next guest, no single justice should be this important. He says one way to minimize that problem would be to have a much bigger Supreme Court. Glenn Reynolds is a professor at the University of Tennessee School of Law and the founder of the InstaPundit blog. He wrote about the court for USA Today. Glenn, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with the number 9. It's not actually in the Constitution, as I understand it, when it comes to the Supreme Court, right? We don't have to have 9 members.
No, that's right. In fact, initially it had 6, and then Congress tried to reduce it to 5, and it's varied both above and below the number 9, but it's been 9 for, roughly 150 years. So by custom, it's become fairly fixed.
Now, I said there's nothing sacred about the number 9, but you write in this piece we're talking about that we've come to almost treat the U.S. Supreme Court like a priesthood, this sacred institution. You are hoping to change the way we think about that.
Yeah, I think, yes, I am. I think we have done that. I think it's been a mixture of confirmation politics and sort of increased prestige for the learned professions. But the Supreme Court is actually, as one of my law professors at Yale told me, a committee. It's not a sacred body. It's a committee, and it is a committee made up of lawyers. And if you ask yourself, who do I want to put in charge of sort of the great moral issues of my time, a committee made of lawyers might not be the first thing you think of, and yet that's what it is. Now, the other thing about it is that it's pretty unrepresentative of America. In fact, it's even unrepresentative of the legal profession. And, you know, Dahlia Lithwick wrote a piece back before Neil Gorsuch got on the court where she pointed out that they were all a bunch of what she called judicial thoroughbreds, with everybody's from Harvard and Yale except for Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who went to that scrappy Ivy League upstart Columbia University. but only after 2 years of Harvard. And, you know, everybody has these prestigious appellate judgeships before, and literally everyone on the court, and this won't change if Kavanaugh is confirmed, literally everybody on the court, Harvard, Yale, and just, so, you know, it's just a, it's the tiniest fraction of the most upper crust part of the legal profession. And, again, that's partly due to confirmation politics. People want a nice, safe brand, and Harvard and Yale are nice, safe brands. But you could think they could reach out a little, at least to, like, you know, Stanford or Michigan or something.
Well, the idea, I guess, might be, okay, the best candidates get in at Harvard and Yale, and then the best of those get in to the minor league of the Supreme Court system, and the best of them make it to the top. So we've got the cream of the cream of the crop here, would be the counterargument. What do you say?
I mean, for certain meaning of best, yes. You know, the law schools test people primarily for having really good LSATs and undergraduate grades when they come in. It's different at Harvard, I think. I went to Yale, where once you're in, you're guaranteed to graduate, basically. You have to really try to screw up. You know, it's nice, and there's nothing wrong with judicial thoroughbreds, except that it's very narrow. And if they were just dealing with technical legal problems, saying, well, they're the best legal minds around, might make some sense. But they keep being called on to function as a sort of set of moral umpires, and I don't know that Ivy League lawyers are the best moral umpires we can produce, and I'm certain they're not the most representative. And plenty of great justices on the Supreme Court didn't have this kind of a background. I mean, Robert Jackson, who was considered one of the greatest minds on the court of the 20th century, actually read law, like Abraham Lincoln, in a lawyer's office. He didn't have a law degree. Of course, many of the earlier justices, that was true. We had people like Earl Warren, who had actually run for election. We have nobody on the Supreme Court who's ever run for election as anything. And so I think, you know, always being in that sort of Ivy League bubble, you're very well-trained in some ways, but you also have a very narrow view of the country. And I thought it was revealing when Gorsuch was nominated, people were talking about how, well, he's going to bring heartland values to the court because he's from Colorado. And, you know, he's from Colorado, but he's a guy who went to Harvard, Yale, and Oxford, and then was a judge of Colorado. So it's not like it's not really some farmer who dropped his plow and went off to the Supreme Court.
Talking to Glenn Reynolds, professor at the University of Tennessee School of Law, founder of the Insta Pundit blog, talking about the U.S. Supreme Court in a piece he wrote in USA Today. Glenn, let's get to your modest proposal here. You want to, if I may use the word, embiggen the U.S. Supreme Court?
Yes. Starting out, my first reflection was that all the hoo-ha over the Kavanaugh appointment tells us something, and what it tells us is that if everything can be turned upside down by a single 80-something-year-old man retiring from the Supreme Court, then the Supreme Court is too sensitive to its input. If one justice can make that big a difference, it probably tells us that the Supreme Court needs to have more justices, so that's less likely to happen. And then my next question was, well, the current system is not very representative, and you could just expand the court, and there are a number of sort of lefty law professors who say that, you know, when we get back in power, we should expand the Supreme Court to make sure there's a reliable leftist majority. But, of course, then Todd Henderson, who's president of the University of Chicago, said, what's to stop Republicans from doing that, too, until we wind up with 1,001 justices on the court? So my proposal was something a little different. And it's sort of semi-serious. I mean, it would take a constitutional amendment, so that limits how serious it can be. My proposal was that we keep the 9 justices we have now, appointed the same way by the president, but then we add one more justice for each state to be appointed by the governor of that state. And my thinking is that, first of all, there'll be more representative. The governors are almost always going to appoint people from their own state, so we'll get some geographic diversity there. We'll get people probably who didn't all go to Harvard and Yale. Who knows? They might have actually even gone to a state law school. I mean, you know, anything could happen. And also, it will mean that when you vote for a president, you're not voting for Supreme Court justices by proxy. I mean, I think you can make a plausible argument. And actually, one of my farthest left colleagues here, I was talking to in the corridor earlier today, who said she really liked this piece, said, you know, I think we got Trump because of the Supreme Court. And I think when you make one of the most important things about a president, who they're going to appoint to the Supreme Court, you then aren't in a position of being able to say, well, who would make the best president as president? And I think that's a real risk. I think it even plays out in Senate elections to some degree. So by expanding this and giving some of that power to state governors, you sort of diffuse that, and you let the other elected offices do what they're supposed to do instead of being a proxy for the Supreme Court. And the other thing about making the Supreme Court bigger is that not only do you make it less sensitive to an individual change here and there, frankly, the Supreme Court doesn't do enough work now. 35, 40 years ago, they heard about twice as many cases as they hear now, and yet the number of cases decided by the courts of appeals was less than a tenth the number of cases that are decided by the courts of appeals today. The Supreme Court is not really providing adequate supervision to lower courts, and if you had that many justices to work with, you could probably set up a system sort of like we have now in the circuit courts, where you have panels and then bigger cases go in bank. And that would provide more supervision for lower courts, which I think would also be good.
So running with this idea, and again, as you say, it's a long shot, you'd have some cases where there's a panel maybe randomly chosen, like, as you say, in lower courts. But you say there would be in bank, which I think means all of them vote. Are we going to have oral arguments in front of, in this case, 59 justices?
Well, you know, how hard is that really? I mean, that's not that many people. It would mean you'd have to control the questioning a little more than you do today, but it doesn't seem like it's unworkable.
And one other thought, people might say, well, this has the kind of the Senate problem where California gets to appoint one judges for all of its huge population. Wisconsin, here we get one for our mid-sized population. Alaska, Wyoming, they get one whole justice for their smaller population.
Well, you know, that's true. Take it up with the framers, I guess. I mean, we have states, and there are other things you could do that would address these problems as well. I mean, one solution, honestly, would be to go to an elected Supreme Court, which it's interesting to me to see the change. I mean, one of the things that's happened in the last year, really, is you've seen a lot of people who previously would never have liked the idea now suggesting that, you know, an elected Supreme Court or justices who serve a single 18-year term, maybe that's not such a bad idea. There are probably lots of ways to address some of these problems, and this is only one of them. But I do think it usefully illustrates what's wrong, and I think if you did it, I think it actually would help. I'd rather doubt we'll ever find out.
What do you think of that idea of the 18-year term limit? I've talked to the head of a group advocating for that. Again, another long shot. It would take a constitutional amendment. Do you think that would do something to lower the stakes, as you say, in like a presidential election?
I think it would. I think people may be fooling themselves, at least people on the left, if they think it's going to make a big difference in the makeup of the court. I haven't done the research myself, but I saw, I believe it was Jonathan Adler of Case Western, saying that if we had had this for the last 50 years, we would have actually had a somewhat more conservative Supreme Court majority than we actually had. And I think any time you start tinkering with the makeup of the court, thinking you know how that's going to play out ideologically over the long term, you're probably wrong. That there are many things that can change things and frustrate your expectations. So I actually think that's the worst reason to restructure the court, but it is, of course, what motivates the most enthusiasm.
Well, what about it seems like there's an absurdity. I'll say, I don't know about you, Glenn, if I'm 85, I don't want to be conditioning my retirement, assuming I'm still working, on the fate of the free world based on who replaces me and who gets to make that appointment. That gets a little weird.
No, you're totally right. And, of course, we've had some disastrous holdovers where Supreme Court justices stayed well past their sell-by date simply to wait out a president. And, you know, William O. Douglas, who I think is a really underrated Supreme Court justice for his intellect, is partly underrated because he stuck out of the court for 4 or 5 years past when he should have gotten off, and was just not very with it during those years, and that sort of, I think, spoiled his reputation. And it's also, again, the two problems of life terms and a smaller Supreme Court make the stakes really high. Whenever a justice retires, the stakes are really high, and the only way I see to get around that, really, is to make the court bigger. But the 18-year terms are not a terrible idea for addressing that either. I'm certainly not against that proposal.
As we wrap up, Glenn, you've got this conversation starter about this 59-justice idea. But do you think anything's really going to change from our 9-member life appointment court in our lifetimes?
Well, if there's anything I've seen about our political class in the last few years, it's that they're very short-sighted and they have very little self-discipline. And so, unfortunately, it's probably a fairly safe bet that we'll see some sort of lame court-packing scheme followed by some other lame court counterpacking scheme until we wind up with a court of 59 Supreme Court justices, just in a different way. And the only thing I'll say about that is that while I think it's a bad idea and I would oppose it, it would at least dilute the importance of an individual seat somewhat. And if it served to reduce the prestige of the court a little bit, and make people think of it as something other than God kings, maybe that wouldn't be so bad either, because they are just lawyers.
Glenn, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Glenn Reynolds is a law professor at the University of Tennessee College of Law and the founder of the Instapundit blog. We talked with him about his recent USA Today column about increasing the number of U.S. Supreme Court justices from 9 to 59. Now, voters in Wisconsin are less than a month away from the August 14th primary elections that include two big midterm races. In the campaign for U.S. Senate, Republicans Leah Vukmir and Kevin Nicholson are competing to take on incumbent Democrat Tammy Baldwin in the November general election. Republican politicians and wealthy donors are lining up on both sides of that race. And 8 Democrats are still in the race for a chance to run against Governor Scott Walker in the fall. Although other elections indicate Democratic enthusiasm is high, the candidates have struggled to gain name recognition and separate themselves from the field. Jonah Ralston is an assistant professor of political science at UW-Whitewater, and he's the coordinator of the university's public policy and administration program. He's with us for a closer look at these races. Jonah, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I think people are expecting a lot of interest in the November elections. Jonah, do you think that these two high-profile primary races are going to get that kind of attention that the general is likely to?
I think that's a really good question. Typically, your primaries are going to have, you know, much lower turnout than the general election. And what can change that would be a really competitive primary field. And, you know, so in 2016, for example, Wisconsin had, almost 50% turnout in the primary election, which, as we know, is a presidential race, which tends to draw more attention. There is the potential that it could be a little bit higher than what we'd normally see. Again, 2016 was a bit of an outlier, though, because that was really back to the 70s when you have rates of like 50% turnout in a primary. So there's the potential, but I would think it'd be unlikely in a midterm to have really high levels.
Yeah, that presidential primary, you had Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton on one side, Donald Trump, and I think it was Ted Cruz still in the race at that point. People saw some pretty high stakes in those primaries. But here, do you think there's going to be a faction of Democrats who say, hey, any of these 8, I'd take over Governor Walker, and Republicans say, either of these 2, I'd take over Tammy Baldwin, so eh. No need to show up on August 14th.
Right. I mean, there certainly is that potential. There, of course, you know, primaries tend to draw the people that are most driven, most, you know, partisan and ideological. So, I expect, of course, that they'll still show up and they'll be interested in wants to vote. It's, you know, it's a matter of the people, like you said, who maybe have made a decision that they're just going to vote Democrat or they're going to vote Republican. Maybe they say, the stakes aren't too high. I'm okay with either.
Let's start by digging in now to the Republican primary in the race for U.S. Senate. We've got Leah Vukmir, has a lot of the backing of the state Republican Party, apparently Governor Walker and others, and then Kevin Nicholson in the race, as of the last Marquette Law School poll, had a lead over Vukmir. Can you talk a little bit about that race?
Yeah, that has turned out to be quite an interesting race. What it seems to be kind of coming down to is more of Vukmir being the establishment candidate, you know, really heavily involved in Wisconsin Republican politics and part of the conservative policies that have been passed here in recent years. And then you have Nicholson, who's comes off more as the outsider. You know, he's a businessman. He was a veteran. And so, well, and he was, interestingly, a Democrat at one point, which I think has caused some problems for him. But he has, you know, gotten some endorsements from, say, you know, Tea Party-affiliated organizations. So, again, we kind of have that schism in the Republican Party on display here in Wisconsin.
I want to give a listen to both of the candidates from their ads. First, Leah Vukmir talking about her conservative credentials as a candidate.
I fought back against the status quo forces in the Capitol that told me, point blank, you will never get anything done if you vote with the conservative wing in the party. They were talking to the wrong person when they said that to me.
And then here's Kevin Nicholson talking in an ad about his position as a political outsider.
There's no shame in making a mistake. There's incredible shame in repeatedly making a mistake and claiming you were right. Career politicians make mistakes and claim they were right, and they keep doing it indefinitely. And they've not been held accountable in the way that they need to.
Ideologically, as far as how these two would vote, Jonah, have they made successfully made distinctions between the two of them?
Well, yes and no. So in the sense that they would support Donald Trump's policies as president, they have expressed that they would both do that. You know, they, for example, the tariffs, the kind of the trade policy issues that are going on right now are not necessarily that popular with the American public, but yet they've both decided that it's safer to side with Trump because they want to make sure they get those voters. But when it comes to other things, for example, Vukmir has said that, you know, she wouldn't commit whether or not she would support Mitch McConnell. She just wants somebody who can get things done. Whereas Nicholson straight out said that he wouldn't necessarily support Mitch McConnell, and because he was not willing to go along with more moderate Republicans like Susan Collins. So there is, you know, some distinctions that they're trying to make, but in the end, they are both pretty similarly in ideologically.
Talking to Jonah Ralston from UW-Whitewater, political scientist there. Looking ahead at next month's primary elections here in Wisconsin, you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you watching the race in your party if you affiliate your affiliations one way or the other? If you're a Republican, do you have a preference here in this race for Senate? If you're a Democrat, who do you like among the eight candidates for governor? If you haven't decided yet, wherever you are on the ideological spectrum and the partisan spectrum, what are you looking for in this primary for governor or Senate, whichever one you're paying attention to? Call in now at 800-642-1234. Let's turn to this race for governor now. Jonah, this is a little unusual. We had 10. Now we're down to 8 candidates still in this race, and not a lot of name recognition, at least according to the last poll from Marquette Law School. What are you looking at there?
Yeah, you think it would have winnowed down a bit further by this point, but a lot of these folks have decided to stay in just to see what happens with the election, thinking that they might be competitive because, you know, each candidate's drawing a certain number of votes, and so whoever gets just a little bit over could maybe put them in. I think the safe money right now is probably on Tony Evers, only because he has won statewide races. He has the name recognition that the other folks do not have at this point. But, you know, looking at some of the funding information that just came out not too long ago, it does look like Roy's is compiling a lot of money, as is Mitchell. So, you know, those two probably are fairly competitive as well. Whereas some of the other candidates, like Soglin, I doubt he's going to be able to pull much. When you look at somebody like Flynn, who's kind of been embroiled in some controversy because of his defense of the Archdiocese of Milwaukee, or you look at somebody like McCabe, who's more of an activist and not really necessarily seen as being a Democratic politician first. So, you know, some of those folks, I think, are going to have a little bit harder time. And again, I would think the safe money here would be on Evers, but you never know. It's a pretty fluid race, though.
It'll be an interesting experiment, I imagine, for political scientists to try to figure out what works in a race like this, whether it's somebody storing up some money and running ads in the week or two before the election, or it's somebody barnstorming around the state trying to make personal connections or really trying to hit one particular interest group. What kinds of tactics are you watching for, curiously, to see how they pan out?
Yeah, you know, it's a really challenging landscape these days, right? Because a lot of people aren't reading newspapers the same way they used to in the past, or watching local TV news. And so I think it's harder to reach voters. And so I do think that name recognition and having run statewide, that's why I kind of lean towards Evers, is because some people, you know, will come into the booth and they might make the decision then. And so it will really help to have already been on a ballot before and so somebody they recognize. Of course, many people will do research and they will, you know, come to their own conclusions. Obviously, these candidates are polling certain numbers, so they do have a level of support already. But for those people who are late deciders, again, I do think there is an advantage to having run a, you know, statewide.
Talking to Jonah Ralston, assistant professor of political science at UW-Whitewater, looking at how the big midterm races are shaping up here in Wisconsin. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're planning to vote in a primary election, whether it's the Republican Senate race or the Democratic primary for governor, have you made up your mind? Have you done that research he was talking about? If not, what are you going to base your decision on among the two or eight candidates, depending on which race you're looking at? Do you give more weight to a candidate's platform, their background, whether you think they'll be competitive with the incumbent they're running against? Are you making a strategic vote? Will you vote for the party's nominee if your preferred candidate does not win? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation, maybe talk to you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation with Jonah Ralston, assistant professor of political science at UW-Whitewater, checking in on the midterm races in Wisconsin for governor and U.S. Senate. Primary election day less than a month away. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Who are you planning to vote for in either of the primaries? The Democrats running for governor, the Republicans running for Senate. Who do you have your eye on? If you haven't made up your mind, what kind of factors will weigh in when you make that decision? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. To your calls now. Tom is with us in Madison. Tom, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. On the Republican side, I'm a little bit dismayed by the amount of extremism that a candidate like Buchmeier is displaying already, by displaying all the sorts of painting Tammy Baldwin as a terrorist, with Islamic terrorists, or having ads with death threats and guns on dining room tables. It seems they're pandering to the extreme Trump base, and that might be good for a short-term political gain, but it just seems it takes the country down into even lower depths.
Tom, thanks a lot for the call. Jonah, the issue facing a lot of Republican primary candidates is how close to run to Donald Trump, how much to reach out to his base as opposed to the Republican base. A lot of overlap there, of course. What do you think about the way the Republican candidates are navigating that here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, no, I think Tom brings up a good point about how in primaries, it's fairly common for these candidates, when they're in a tough election, to actually tack further to, you know, their ideological extreme, whether that's Republicans going further right or Democrats going further left. And it's not uncommon because, you know, they are trying to attract, their base of support, and they're fighting over that base of support. So they're kind of trying to outdo one another. Who's more conservative? And I think it's even more challenging for Buchmeier in this instance, because we know that the political landscape right now is favoring the more anti-establishment candidates, hence, you know, Nicholson polling so well, even though, you know, he didn't have the support of the state party. And also he hasn't gotten the same level of endorsement that Buchmeier has.
Let's go back to our callers now. Aaron is with us in Milwaukee. Aaron, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. In the Democratic race for governor, I'm looking very closely at Mike McCabe. Unlike, while many of the Democratic candidates for governor are talking the same line on many of the issues, Mike McCabe is the only candidate that I've heard, and I've been to two governor forums so far, making campaign finance and corruption in our government a primary issue in his campaign. So that really sets him apart from the crowd for me.
Aaron, thanks a lot for that call. And Jonah, Mike McCabe, maybe try to make a case that he's the outsider in the Democratic field.
Yeah, I think he could make that argument. But in this case,
lying on the ground inside the priest's house, and no one could get.
Sorry, I'm going to cut in here. We had some stray audio. Pick up where you left off there on Mike McCabe. Jonah, I don't know if you heard that.
Yeah, so I think with Mike McCabe, one of the issues is that perhaps he's seen as too much of an outsider, right? I mean, there is an equilibrium you want to have where you do want to be seen as, anti-establishment candidate in this particular political landscape. But then again, you also do need the support of the partisan loyal, right? I mean, these loyal partisans who are Democrats who are wondering if Mike McCabe, who talks about both parties as being failing parties, is really truly going to represent them as a Democrat.
Thanks a lot for that call, Aaron. We'll go next to Margaret in Madison. Margaret, hi.
Hi. I am here to put in a good word for Tony Evers. I think Tony Evers is one of the few candidates who really has a grip on what's happening in all of the small towns and rural areas in this state. He has been to every school district to try and help them work through education funding issues that they face, declining enrollments, economic decline, and he's from small-town Wisconsin as well. So I think he is someone who really understands the angst that rural voters feel, that their future may not live up to their past expectations.
Margaret, thanks a lot for that call. So she's saying Evers, I mean, who Republicans would probably try to paint as a Madison-based Democrat, she's making the case that because of his contact with schools, he might have some street cred outside of Madison.
Yeah, and he's probably going to need to play that up, right, to try to get some of these crossover voters, the ones that had voted for Obama but then voted for Trump. And, that, you know, he's going to need to capture that demographic and turn it back Democratic. One interesting thing is, you know, Margaret mentioned about the focus on education. That certainly is a big campaign issue that's going to happen for this gubernatorial election. That does seem to benefit him more than it would some of the other candidates.
Margaret, thanks for that call. Going next to Steve on the line with us in Marshall. Steve, hello.
Hello. I was wondering why your guest had not brought up Kathleen Beinhout in his naming of her candidates. I think she has a lot of rural appeal, certainly knows Wisconsin politics very well. She's the only candidate who has come up with alternative budgets during Walker's reign. And I think she would have a rural appeal and would also catch a lot of votes from main areas like Milwaukee and Madison.
Steve, thanks for a lot for the call. Yeah, we didn't go through all eight candidates one at a time, Jonah, but Kathleen Beinhout, she's been talked about as a potential candidate in years past for statewide office. What are you looking at with her campaign?
Yeah, I think Beinhout would try to say that she is the candidate that can get those crossover voters best, actually, because she does represent more rural area in Wisconsin, and she has won, you know, several elections. So I do think that that is something that would be, you know, kind of a feather in her cap, so to speak. But I'm not sure her polling has been really there where it would suggest that she's in the top tier of candidates right now. She does have name recognition. That is true, and that will help her. But it'll be interesting to see if she's able to differentiate herself from this crowded field.
Steve, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Jonah Ralston, political scientist at UW-Whitewater, is with us looking ahead at the primary elections coming up next month, August 14th, here in Wisconsin. Two high-profile races, two Republicans in the primary to challenge Tammy Baldwin for her U.S. Senate seat, and eight Democrats running in a primary to compete with Scott Walker in the governor's race. Back to your calls. Chris is on the line in Columbus. Chris, hello.
Hey, I got to tell you, you know, Scott Walker has really turned me off to Wisconsin Republicans. But, you know, I'm waiting for the Democrats to actually put up a candidate that appeals to just the regular guy. And they just don't do it. They keep trotting out people that only appeal to liberals. And you know what? I just can't do it. I have to vote for Walker because none of the eight voters would actually, you know, support Wisconsin jobs. You know, at the forum, none of them wanted to support the Foxconn project, which, granted, it's not perfect, but it's going to bring a ton of jobs to Wisconsin.
Hey, Chris, I wanted to ask, is there somebody who's run in the past or you'd like to see run as a Democrat who might fit the bill for you?
You know, if there would be a William Proxmire that would rise up and be just a common sense Democrat who was for the small business owner and, you know, and a hunter and firearms enthusiast, that would be the best thing in the world.
Chris, thanks a lot for the call. Jonah, interesting perspective there. He'd like to see a Democrat he could vote for, he says.
Yeah, and I'm wondering if Chris would be supporting Baldwin, actually, because he might be one of those rare voters who splits the ticket. And, you know, it's a less common phenomenon. 20, 30 years ago, you'd have, you know, over one out of five voters actually splitting the ticket on some of these top races. But that's dropped to less than 10% nowadays. But, you know, they could be very important here where you might have someone who says, well, I'm going to put Walker back in. He's a known commodity, and that's what I'm going to go with. But I'm also going to put Tammy Baldwin back into the Senate. And, you know, even if it's a small percent, if these are close races, you know, they're called unicorn voters, right? Because people hear about them, but they're very rare to ever find one these days. So, you know, if we have some of these unicorn voters, you know, they could actually make the difference in this election by putting in Walker as governor and Baldwin into the Senate.
Briefly, as we wrap up, Jonah, new Marquette University Law School poll scheduled to come out tomorrow. Just real quick, what is a tea leaf you're looking to read tomorrow?
Well, I think one thing you're going to be interested in, of course, is looking at the favorability ratings on Baldwin. That was one of her weak points, actually. She wasn't polling very well for favorability ratings. And then, of course, seeing where these Democratic candidates are in the field, it might get us a better idea, a preview of how the primary might turn out. And, of course, that really close primary for Senate on the Republican side as well.
Jonah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me. It was my pleasure.
Jonah Ralston is an assistant professor of political science at UW-Whitewater. He was with us to check in on how the state's big midterm elections are shaping up with less than a month before the primaries.